Good day, everyone. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM, online at www.ciut.fm. And as always, you can find our past shows for download and learn more about our show at animalvoices.ca and get our podcast there as well. I'm your host, Rob Moore, here with the lovely Lamia Gibson. Hey there.
Hi, Rob.
As she grabs for the microphone. It's a pretty varied show today. After the news, we're going to be talking about nutritional yeast. And you use nutritional yeast, right?
I do, and I have some very pressing questions for this person here.
Excellent. Well, we're going to get to that after the news. I think nutritional yeast is kind of a strange food product, in my opinion. And my family had an aquarium growing up. And you know that flake fish food, you know, for aquarium fish? Well, that's what I thought it was when I first actually saw nutritional yeast. So I thought, well, that kind of scares me. So I kind of thought maybe it scares other people too.
It used to scare me, I think, but once I started eating it, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, once you realize what you can do with it and the kind of things that it enhances, all the flavors and everything, it can be pretty interesting. So to demystify nutritional yeast and tell us everything you can do with it is Joe Stepaniak, author of The Ultimate Uncheese Cookbook, and we'll talk about grilled cheese sandwiches and lasagna and all this amazing stuff you can do with it. And then we couldn't get him last week, but we're doing a second segment on seal ecotourism with Stephen Morello, a guide with Natural Habitat and director of Green Planet Expeditions. He'll tell us about Natural Habitat's harp seal ecotourism trips that are often guided by ex-seal hunters who agree not to hunt if given an alternative source of revenue. I think that's pretty interesting. So we'll continue to explore the possibility of saving and celebrating the seals here in Canada. First, the news and a few items about the seals. This first one is a hint of possible success, I think, regarding the proposal of last week's guest, Kathy Kangas. Remember that Kangas, CEO and founder of Pry Beauty, has offered the federal government $16 million to stop the controversial slaughter off Canada's East Coast. From the Canadian Press, the Federal Fisheries Department said Ottawa would not be taking Kangas up on her offer, but some island sealers say they're willing to consider it. I talked to quite a few of the license holders here in PEI, and everyone is willing to give this a try, said Kenneth McLeod, a sealer from Murray River. McLeod said island fishermen can earn up to $10,000 a year from the seal hunt, but he said a buyout would need to cover future earnings as well. We like to explore the alternatives, he said. It's the 21st century. McLeod said island fishermen have been talking to Kangas, who plans on visiting the province for face-to-face meetings soon. And on last week's show, we mentioned how it can be a dangerous business killing seals. Well, no kidding. From canoe.ca, a hunter aboard a sealing vessel was airlifted to hospital after a gun exploded and injured his hand. The injured man was airlifted Friday to hospital on the northern tip of Newfoundland. Search and rescue officials have received a number of calls since the hunt opened Wednesday, although most calls have been minor. A press release from the Humane Society of the United States says, the illegal and violent actions by seal hunt supporters this year have exposed the depths to which the sealing industry and Canadian government are prepared to sink to defend the indefensible, stated Rebecca Aldworth, Director of Canadian Wildlife Issues for the HSUS. Angry crowds used violent tactics to try and stop us from leaving for the hunt area, said Vera Weber, coordinator of the Franz Weber Foundation. The local police did nothing to prevent this. Having witnessed firsthand the way that the Canadian government colludes with this corrupt industry, I can only compare it to a banana republic. I travel extensively around the world in my work, and this is the first time I have ever witnessed anything like this. Canada should be ashamed. In Blanc Sablon, observers were held hostage by a crowd measuring in excess of 80 people. Vehicles attempting to depart for nearby helicopters were followed, and one was rammed by a local truck and forced off the road, endangering the lives of the journalists inside. My conclusion from being here over the past week is that the sealers and the Canadian government obviously have something to hide since they go to such great lengths to bar observation of the hunt, said Carl Schleichter, a Swedish member of the European Parliament. The only logical solution is for us to take initiatives at the European level and follow the example of Belgium and Italy, who have already banned all seal products. The footage that was obtained of the seal hunt in the front shows clear violations of the marine mammal regulations that govern the hunt, including sealers shooting seals, then clubbing them, and finally stabbing them with hooks and dragging them across the ice, all without checking to ensure the animals are dead. Next from Reuters, one of the main safeguards against mad cow disease, a ban on using cattle parts in cattle feed, is ineffective or is not enforced strictly, two U.S. consumer groups said on Monday in light of a new case of the fatal bovine ailment in Canada. Both groups urged more stringent rules on the ingredients allowed in livestock feed and stronger enforcement of the existing ban. Canada's latest case, confirmed on Sunday, was a 6-year-old purebred Holstein dairy cow in British Columbia. Caroline Smith-DeWall of the Center for Science in the Public Interest said the new Canadian case suggested there was probably contaminated feed being served to cattle in the early 2000s, so enforcement of the feed ban may not have been effective in Canada. From the USA Today, a livestock tracking system planned by the U.S. government will not include the age of animals, despite the key role age has played in mad cow disease investigations. Agriculture Department officials say they don't want to overburden ranchers and can track most birth dates. Critics said the omission could make the system worthless. The department promised to create the system after the nation's first case of mad cow disease 2 years ago and has already spent $84 million on it. Earlier this month, Agriculture Secretary Mike Johans promised it would be in place by 2009. Interesting story from the BBC. High-protein, low-carb diets should be avoided during pregnancy, as they can lead to more stressed offspring, research suggests. A UK team followed a group of 86 children born in 1967 to 68 to mothers who were told to eat a pound of red meat a day to avoid pregnancy complications. The study found the more meat the mother ate, the higher the levels of stress hormone cortisol in the child. The subjects, now in their 30s, were asked by the research teams to perform a series of stressful tasks, including public speaking and mental arithmetic. Their blood pressure levels were recorded, and cortisol levels were measured before and after each task. Dr. Rebecca Reynolds, who led the study, said, "This study adds to the increasing evidence of the importance of the maternal diet and suggests that one of the ways in which it can have these long-term effects is by permanently altering stress hormone levels." Dr. Doris Campbell said, "These sorts of high-protein, low-carb diets are not particularly healthy in general, but I certainly would not advocate them in pregnancy." And we have someone online. Yes, all right. I'm going to skip the last portion of the news because our next guest is on the line to join us. She is the author of The Ultimate Uncheese Cookbook. Her name is Jo Stepanek, and she uses nutritional yeast to concoct all sorts of cheesy recipes like grilled cheese sandwiches and lasagna. But I think a lot of people don't really know what nutritional yeast is, and even those of us who use it aren't quite sure what it is either. So here to answer that question again, Jo Stepanek. Jo, welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. It's always great to have you back.
Thank you.
So, yes, like I said, the first time I saw nutritional yeast, I thought for sure it was that aquarium fish food. Do you know what I mean, that aquarium flake fish food? And truthfully, yeah, it kind of scared me, and I think it might seem strange to others. So please tell us, what is nutritional yeast?
Well, nutritional yeast is a natural item that we find in the air and on our skin, and that is used to rise sourdough bread. It's a perfectly natural phenomenon that we use in a lot of things every day, but nutritional yeast just happens to be a particular strain of yeast, and it is deliberately grown rather than sort of found by chance in the air. It is grown in a lab, but it is a natural occurring thing, and the nutritional yeast that I recommend is actually very good tasting. There are other types of nutritional yeast, such as brewer's yeast, that people often confuse with nutritional yeast. And yeast is also made or used in the brewing industry to make beer, for example, and ale. But the byproduct of that industry, the brewer's yeast, is very bitter. And it has some of the same nutritional components as nutritional yeast, but it is not very good tasting, and it's not something that you want to use to cook with or really to eat.
Right. So nutritional yeast, it's in that flake form. Is there a reason why it's in that flake form? Is that kind of like a way to concentrate food?
Well, I'm not really sure why it's flaked. It originally was used in the commercial food industry, and it still is, to add a cheesy flavor to foods such as corn chips, that manufacturers wanted to add a cheesy taste to actually enhance foods that even those that already have dairy products in them. But it is completely dairy-free. Depending on how much it gets jostled during shipping, those flakes may turn out to be powder. So you can get it in two different forms, and the powder actually is much more concentrated than the flakes because it's heavier, and the particles are heavier and smaller, so you would use less of the powder than you would of the flakes if you're following a recipe.
So that's interesting. It's being used commercially already in certain products, too, to add that cheesy flavor.
That's how it was originally discovered.
Hmm.
It was discovered by the vegetarian community of the farm in Summertown, Tennessee, back in the 70s. Actually, it was probably back in the late 60s. And they looked at it as a way to add B12 to their diet in a way that they would not have to take additional supplements. And they also found that it had so many other valuable nutritional components. So they began adding it to their food, and they were the first in North America to really use it in a consumer way. And they originally, one of their small businesses, began distributing nutritional yeast to the consumer market back in the early 70s. And I even remember the little packages that they had back then. They sold it in little paper bags. It was quite cute, and they had a giant sun on the front, and it called it good-tasting yeast.
Good-tasting yeast. So you mentioned B12 is in nutritional yeast. Is it naturally in nutritional yeast, or is it something that's added?
B12 is not really naturally found in anything. It is caused by bacterial contamination. So if we want to consider that natural, it is. But it's not really a natural part of animal products either, because any B12 found in animal products is also found through bacterial contamination. So it's really not naturally found in any food. It's through bacteria found in water or soil, but because we wash our foods and because we have to purify our water, it's not found in those natural places. So any B12 that is in any kind of vegetable food in any concentration that is measurable has been added, but it is through bacterial contamination. Yeast in general has a good amount of the B complex vitamins. Not all of them, it depends on which yeast it is. But not all nutritional yeast contain vitamin B12. The one that I recommend is made by Red Star Yeast Company, and it's packaged by other companies, so it can be sold under other names. In the United States and possibly in Canada, one of the other companies that repackages Red Star Vegetarian Support Nutritional Yeast is KAL, K-A-L, and that package will state in small print vegetarian support formula on it, so you know you're getting the right one. But if you purchase another brand of nutritional yeast, you will need to look at the nutritional panel on the package to see if it indeed does contain vitamin B12, because many do not. And you want to make sure that if it does, what amount it contains, because you want to make sure that you're getting a good quantity of it.
Can people find this in normal grocery stores?
Well, it probably depends where you live, but most traditional, conventional supermarkets do not carry nutritional yeast. It's a product that you do have to look for in your food co-op or your natural food store. It may be sold in the bulk food section, and what you want to look for is the label nutritional yeast or preferably vegetarian support formula, and you want to make sure that it is flaky and fresh and dry and a nice bright yellow color.
Okay. And what is the rest of the nutritional value of nutritional yeast? So it has B12. And, well, let's talk specifically about the nutritional yeast that you recommend, the Red Star.
Mm-hmm.
What's the nutritional profile of that?
Well, it contains a variety of vitamins and minerals. Again, you know, it depends on the brand. And also it depends on the amount of per serving that the manufacturer recommends. Bearing in mind that nutritional yeast serves two purposes. It does serve to be a nutritional supplement, and it also serves to be a flavor enhancer. It's not a food that you want to necessarily eat by yourself, just as you wouldn't eat spoonfuls of salt or other kinds of flavoring or ketchup, but you can use it as a condiment or a food in addition to recipes to make them taste better or to add certain flavors to them, which I can talk about in a minute. For the nutritional yeast that I recommend, the serving size is 16 grams, and that comes out to approximately 2 tablespoons in U.S. measurements, and that's of the large flakes. Now, if your nutritional yeast turns out to be more powdery, depending on the brand, the type, or how much it has been jostled in shipping and been reduced, then you may want to reduce that daily amount to about 1 heaping tablespoon or 1.5 tablespoons, depending on how powdery it actually is. For that amount, for that 16 grams, there are 47 calories, and there are 8 grams of protein. So people often find that nutritional yeast is a nice protein, adds a nice protein boost to foods. It has 5 grams of carbohydrates and 4 grams of fiber. It's virtually fat-free. So there, you don't have to worry about saturated fat. You don't have to worry about fat if you're on a low-fat diet.
Yeah, it does sound pretty healthy.
It is.
Yeah, it sounds like a nice supplement for anyone, really.
It would be actually a great addition for anyone, regardless of what diet they follow. Whether they're vegetarian, whether they're vegan, or whether they're an omnivore, nutritional yeast adds a wonderful profile of nutrients as well as a delicious taste to anybody's food.
And we're going to talk about the foods in just a minute, but Lamia, you had a question about, I think, the storage of it.
Yeah, there's... Hi, Jill.
Hi.
There's been a bit of a debate amongst friends of mine and myself whether or not nutritional yeast is supposed to be stored, 1, in the fridge, and 2, in a airtight container, and 3, with no light hitting it, so like some kind of taped up or something jar.
Well, you're all right. The answer is yes. Well, the manufacturer states that the nutritional yeast should be stored in the refrigerator. I don't recommend that because in order for it to really keep well, it needs to stay dry and flaky. If you're going to store it in the refrigerator, you want to make sure that it is in a completely airtight, moisture-proof container. But it's not really necessary to store it in the refrigerator. You can store it at room temperature, which is what I do, in an airtight container away from heat and moisture, and also away from light. The reason to keep it away from heat and light is because those two can destroy certain vitamins. So you want to make sure that the yeast is not exposed to light over a long period of time. As long as it is kept dry and away from light and away from heat, you'll be able to maintain the nutrient profile from the date of purchase for approximately 1 year. The yeast itself will remain useful indefinitely as long as it stays dry and flaky. It's just as with any supplement, over time, because of air, because of time, because of light, because of heat, the nutrients are going to diminish somewhat. So they'll still have some potency, but just not as much as the day they were purchased.
In that case, would you advise against buying nutritional yeast in, say, a bulk section due to it being exposed to light and heat and air regularly, like in a bulk bin?
I purchase my nutritional yeast in the bulk bin, but I know there is good turnover. It's with anything with bulk purchases. You want to make sure that there is good turnover. As long as something has been sitting out for a long period of time, its chances of the nutrients in it diminishing somewhat are probably pretty likely, but that's going to take a fair amount of time. There should be no problem with purchasing nutritional yeast from the bulk bin.
All right, so tell us, I mean, you've obviously experimented quite a bit to create your ultimate uncheese cookbook. Give us some examples of some things that you have created.
Oh, my. I didn't know you were going to ask that one.
Oh, yeah. We got to tempt some people's appetites out there.
Well, I have almost any type of dairy cheese that you can think of. I have created a vegan, totally dairy-free alternative. And most of them do contain nutritional yeast because nutritional yeast not only enhances the nutrient content, but it boosts that cheesy flavor. So I have many uncheeses that range from sauces and fondues to things like ricotta, to sliceable uncheeses, to spreads, cream cheese, cheddar cheese type spreads, on and on, as well as a variety of casseroles and soups and sauces and dressings that all have a scrumptious, cheesy taste. And you don't have to make the other types of cheeses to make those. Everything is designed so it can be very simple, quick, and easy to make. In fact, most of my recipes, I'm somewhat of a lazy cook, and I don't want to have anyone do anything I wouldn't be willing to do. And I'm not willing to spend hours and hours in the kitchen unless I'm developing a recipe. When it comes time to cook dinner, I want it to go fast and easy. So most of my recipes contain ingredients you can just throw into your blender, add hot water, if that, turn it on, and pretty much you're ready to go. So I say if anybody can boil water and operate a small electrical appliance, they can make uncheeses.
And what I really like about it, too, is that especially with the healthy profile of nutritional yeast, there's so much research out there that we know about that dairy is quite actually harmful to a person's diet. And so I like the fact that we can still have some of our old favorites like grilled cheeses and lasagnas and, like you said, fondues and sauces and like that. But these are healthier versions. So you don't have to give up your old comfort foods. All you have to do is discover these new types of foods and a healthier way of having them.
Absolutely. And what is great about making them yourself is that you can make them as rich or as low fat as you want to. And if you don't like a particular ingredient, you can leave it out. If you do like something, you can add it. Some people love hot peppers, for instance, hot chilies in their uncheeses, and some people dislike them. So you have that choice. You can make yourself a hot pepper jack, Monterey Jack cheese if you want to, or you can make something very mild. You can reduce the sodium in the uncheeses if you want to.
Right. And like I told you, I recently had one of your grilled cheese sandwiches, and the recipe was in Neil Bernard's Breaking the Food Seduction.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, I haven't had a real grilled cheese in probably 10 years. And I have to tell you, it was so good that I think I've had it, I don't know, I probably had 10 grilled cheese sandwiches in the past couple of weeks because I love it so much. It's really it's that gooey grilled cheese, you know, that you loved when you were little, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, and for our listeners, Joe has also given me a couple recipes that I've posted on our website under this show at animalvoices.ca. There's a seasoning mix and I forget what the second one was.
It's a marinade, chili marinade.
Right, yeah. So go check those out, and you can start to experiment with nutritional yeast. And I'm sure there are other recipes on the net, too, that you can find to start exploring the whole world of nutritional yeast. But the cookbook, again, that Joe created was The Ultimate Uncheese Cookbook. And for the link to that and to learn more about Joe, visit animalvoices.ca. Do you have any other special tips that people should know as to how to use nutritional yeast?
Well, you can add nutritional yeast. Just don't overdo it until you know whether or not you like it. Add a small amount to start. You can add it to your casseroles, to your soups, to your dips. Nutritional yeast is also great in scrambled tofu because it can add a kind of eggy taste. Depending on how it's used, it can add a poultry-like flavoring to gravies and sauces. So it can do more than just add a cheesy flavor. Depending on how it's used, the other herbs and seasonings it's used with, and the type of recipe it is overall. So start slowly. Don't overdo it because it is a nutritional supplement. You don't want to have too much of it. And enjoy it.
That's awesome, Joe. Thanks so much for being with us and educating us about, I was going to say entertaining us, which it was entertaining as well. Entertaining and educating us about nutritional.
Welcome back. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5. Over to you, Rob.
Thanks, Lamia. Again, welcome back. So we're going to go to our interview with Stephen Morello. We're following up last week's show with an additional segment on exploring the seal ecotourism industry on the east coast of Canada as a replacement of revenue for the commercial seal hunt. Steve is a guide with Natural Habitat Adventures, founder and director of Green Planet Expeditions, and well-known wildlife photographer whose work has appeared in National Geographic, International Wildlife, The New York Times, and perhaps the calendar on your wall. Steve, welcome to Animal Voices.
Thank you. Thank you, Ruff. Good to be here.
Thanks. Tell us first about Natural Habitat's seal watching expeditions.
Well, the seal watch program began in 1988, and it was started actually under the nudging of the International Fund for Animal Welfare simply to show an alternative to the seal hunt, an alternative to the economy of the seal hunt, and replacing that with an economy based on tourism. So it wasn't really, it wasn't started by the International Fund for Animal Welfare. It was their idea. Natural Habitat Adventures is a tour company. It's a tour operator. It's not an advocacy group. Whether or not those of us who work for the company do advocate the ending of the hunt, whatever, that's besides the point. The whole purpose of the seal watch is to bring people to see the seals out in the Gulf of St. Lawrence.
And these seals that people go to watch, are they watching them being born?
Well, that would be exciting. It's very, very difficult to, it's a very rare sight to actually see a pup being born, but they're going out onto the ice to see the pups.
To see the baby seals with the white fur, and they're cute and cuddly.
Exactly.
I wonder if those seals then go on to be hunted after the tourists, you know, go away.
Certainly the possibility exists. We understand that would be a very difficult thing for most of our clients to deal with, the fact that they're there taking photos of these beautiful little seals, and a couple of weeks later that they may end up being clubbed for their pelts or whatever. So with that in mind, we strive to visit seals that we hope would be spared from the hunt. We have helicopters so that we're able to sometimes get to areas that the boats and things wouldn't be able to get to.
And you've been with Natural Habitat since the 1989, right?
Exactly. I'm one of the founders.
Okay. And can you tell us, so was that successful under the International Fund for Animal Welfare, their nudging of this this business to replace revenue loss in the seal hunt? Was that successful for some sealers?
You know, it's a difficult question to answer. It's semi-successful. It's a many-faceted situation. First of all, it's certainly a successful program for Natural Habitat Adventures. However, and the program has changed over the years, you know, and there, the amount of seal watchers that go to, say, the Magellan Islands every single year to see the seals has certainly made a difference in the economy of the island. I wouldn't say tremendously. I wouldn't say that it has changed the face of the economy of the Magdalen Islands, but it certainly has had an impact. And over the years, we know from the local Chamber of Commerce, the businesses and things of that sort, that they very much look forward to the arrival of the Seal Watch tourists every year. Now, has that impacted the sealers themselves? Yes, a few of them, because that's whom we hire as our guides on the ice. But to be perfectly honest here and frank, it's a very small amount. You know, it's just a few people. Certainly the bulk of the money that we bring into the islands goes to hotels, restaurants, shops, and things of that sort.
Right.
But with that said, also you need to realize that seal watching isn't as big as it could be. And part of the reason for that is the fact that it's very difficult to sell a tour to people to go to see seals with the understanding on behalf of the client that, as you suggested, some of the seals that they might be going to see are going to be clubbed in a few weeks.
Right.
And as a result of that, it makes it probably our most difficult tour to sell.
Yeah, because truthfully, I did not know about this these seal watches until I started researching this. Well, until Rebecca Aldworth turned me on to you, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's been happening for a while. You know, it gets more play probably. Most of our client base is from the United States. And not so much from Canada. And that's just simply the way the marketing happens, whether it's through magazines or direct mailing here and things of that sort. This is where we live. This is our market base. So most of our marketing material goes to people here in the U.S. And so, you know, I suspect it's less likely to be known in Canada.
Right. Some of the guides are actually ex-sealers, and I read on the website that they're given those positions provided they stop hunting seals. Is that right?
That's correct. They have to sign a contract with us that says that they are not going to be hunting seals, at least for that year. Obviously, we don't have control over them for the rest of their lives, but for that year, they sign a contract that says if they're going to work for us, they're not going to hunt seals.
Who came up with that idea?
Oh, that was our idea. That was one of the things is, basically it's a response to our clients, our guests, who say, geez, you know, I want to make sure that I'm not supporting someone who's going out to show me the seals and then in 2 weeks goes right back out to that same place now that they know where the seals are and stuff, although that changes every single day where the seals are. But the clients say, you know, we don't want to be bringing the sealers out to see the seals and then them going back when we leave to go and hunt them. So we said to them, well, that won't be the case, and the way that we can ensure that is certainly by a simple thing of making a contract with them.
And that's just excellent. I mean, that is an excellent idea, and perhaps, I mean, I don't think a lot of people know that right now, and perhaps they're thinking that's almost an idea before its time, in a way that, you know, people are trying to get this kind of thing started right now, whereas you had already started it, you know, almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, and, you know, it's an evolution. Ecotourism in general is an evolutionary process. It needs change as it goes on all the time. Every single year, we enact new little nuances into the program to, some of it is to make the trip better for the clients, but certainly some of it is in all of our tours to make it a better tour in terms of the sensitivity to the environment and to the wildlife that we're going to be going to see.
Something I'd like you to talk about. You had asked one of your guides who is an ex-sealer to be on the show, and his response and his experience, I think, really helps to illustrate the difficulty some sealers face if they leave the industry. Could you share his story with us?
Well, basically, he's apprehensive simply because he lives on the island. And all of our seal guides who have been in that position, they live on the island, and their friends and sometimes their family are sealers. And they're not necessarily, to tell you the truth, against the hunt. They won't be sealing anymore. And they, you know, our particular guides have said they, after bringing people to the ice and seeing the difference, even though they may not be particularly against the hunt, they're not particularly interested in ever going hunting again after showing them to the guests. But, you know, the problems they face is the peer pressures, and the peer pressures can be anything from, hey, I'm not going to talk to you anymore, you're helping those seal watchers, to I'm not going to, you know, maybe buy your fish anymore. You're a local fisherman, and, you know, I have the fish packing plant, and, hey, I'm also a sealer, so you want to support those other people, tell them to buy the fish. So it can be difficult for them. I think that over the years, especially on the Magellan Islands, the Seal Watch program has developed an understanding with the local people. And, you know, we have said to them right from the very beginning, our feelings are our feelings, and we're a tourist group. We're not an advocacy group. We've always given the sealers an opportunity to come and actually talk to our clients and present their side of the story, because we certainly represent, well, I shouldn't say represent, but we present the scientific side of the story and the conservation side of the story. And we've said to them, you know, come here and tell the people how you feel and put your face to the argument and let them hear from you and see. And so things were very, very good. And often sealers have come to talk to the tourists in the beginning years. It was a little touchy. We never knew if there was going to be an argument that ensued, but over the years things got very, very civil and an understanding was reached. But this past year, I think, particularly because of Paul McCartney being on the ice, other celebrities have been on the ice before and have certainly voiced their opinion against the hunt. But Paul McCartney is a megastar, and for whatever reason, he has certainly, it seems to have reignited the spark against the hunt. And so this year, particularly, the Sealers are much more, they seem to be more touchy about the whole issue and more apprehensive about anyone from the outside who isn't pro-sealing.
Right. And I think that's excellent that you were doing that, bringing the Sealers, because I think to keep that dialogue open is really important.
Oh, I think so, too. And I have always said that, you know, conversation goes much, much further than confrontation.
Definitely.
You know, and I know we have a tendency to villainize the Sealers. I don't particularly think they're bad people. I think they're great people on the Magellan Islands. Mm-hmm. I think in Newfoundland they're great people. The maritime people have always been warm and friendly and great, and I love being there. On the other hand, I also think that, you know, we have a difference of opinion. But that doesn't make them a bad person. It doesn't make me a bad person for simply not wanting to hunt seals.
Right.
For simply wanting to enjoy them or to see them or to have them exist without the threat of being hunted there. And you know, it doesn't make either one of us bad. They have a situation. And, you know, they're not the ones who created the market. It was the Western world who bought the product. It's like the whole question of overfishing in general. We hear about overfishing and we tend to say, oh, those fishermen. Well, it's not those fishermen. It's those fishermen and us consumers as well. And it's a problem. You know, the lack of fisheries is a big problem, not just for the fish, but for us and for the fishermen and things as well. Times have changed. Times are continually changing. And unfortunately, the fishermen, in this case, the sealers, are getting the brunt of the protest, or they're feeling the economic hurt maybe more than any of the rest of us here, but things have changed. It's not the same. And I think it's time to have a realistic approach to the whole fisheries. I mean, the maritime provinces, they were so aggressive in the protection of their fisheries. They closed the cod fishing industry. And that, from a conservation standpoint, is incredible. And the idea that they would close it completely and face, Canada closes it completely, they face the wrath of the maritime fishermen, but they did it because it needed to be done. I wish they were so aggressively conservative in the United States, with our cod fisheries, but we're not. You know, and so on one hand, they're doing this incredible job, and on the other hand, they say, well, we're still going to allow the sealing to go on. And it just, you know, it, there seems to be some mixed messages here for me.
Definitely. You said that that it's not as big as it could be, these seal ecotourism adventures. Well, first of all, actually, could you paint us a picture of what it looks like when, you know, you go out onto the ice and you do these seal watching expeditions? What do people expect to see?
It's magical. Just being on the ice itself is an incredible experience. To understand that you're standing on a couple of hundred feet of ocean, and during the rest of the year, just for a few short weeks, really, of the year, that it's frozen solid, and that you're in a place that not very many people in the world ever get a chance to experience. It's quite beautiful. It's extremely dramatic. It can be desolate. It can be brutal. If it's windy and snowing, it can be sunny and blue skies and warm out there. It's incredible. And then to be able to be so close to the harp seals, and especially the pups, and close enough to pet them, and to have these seals right there, and it literally does change people's lives.
Do you think that then the seal ecotourism industry, do you think it could be bigger, you know, if the seal hunt was completely replaced, if enough planning and energy went into it, and that, you know, you brought worldwide attention to, as you said, this kind of magical experience to Newfoundland?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I find that no matter where I go, whatever tourism I'm participating in, and I find that actually in the United States, right now there is a large, well, a desire on behalf of many lodges and things here in the West. I live in Colorado. And out here in the West, Colorado, Wyoming, any of the places out here, Utah, Montana, there are a lot of hunting lodges. And the hunting lodges now are finding that more and more people are interested to come out to see the wildlife on photographic safaris as opposed to hunting safaris, or just in terms of watching wildlife. And I'm often asked by the owner of the lodges what they can do to get more of those people in their non-hunting season. And the big issue there is, well, you can't look at it as a non-hunting season. You can't be bringing people up here to see the elk or the bear or the moose or whatever while you still have brochures in your lobby that say, oh, you know, you can come here in the fall and hunt and get the big pointers and things of that sort. I said, it's just not going to fly with people. They're not interested in seeing the animals that they feel may, in fact, in a couple of weeks be hunted. If you go to a lodge and they have trophy mounts on the wall and heads of all the different animals that have been shot there, it just is not going to fly for lack of a better word, the ecotourist.
Indeed.
And so until the hunt actually is severely curtailed, people who do want to go and see the seals just aren't going to go. You know, it just doesn't work. And that's whether you're pro-hunt or anti-hunt or whatever, from a purely tourism-based economic argument, until the hunt stops, you're never going to have as many people going to see the seals.
And don't you think, too, if the seal hunt was stopped, and I mean, this thing has gotten so much negative publicity internationally, that if it was stopped and, you know, they invited the world to come and celebrate these seals, that the world would, you know, descend on Newfoundland and Labrador, and they'd have so many tourists and so many tourist dollars that they wouldn't know what to do with?
Well, a good example is their whale watching industry.
I was just going to ask you about that. Please go on.
In Newfoundland, and I can't really speak from a voice of authority here because I only know about it peripherally, but I know that, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, their whale watch industry was pretty much nothing. You know, it started up, people weren't sure, it wasn't a big deal. Now, it's a very important part of the economy, and I know in St. John's and in other areas. So it's grown incredibly, and the same thing in our own East Coast, where I was involved in the whale watch industry. When we first started over 25 years ago, there were two boats who did whale watching on weekends when they didn't do fishing. Now there are dozens of boats. It's a multi-million-dollar industry, and they can't. They don't have enough boats to handle the amount of people that are there during the summer.
Hmm. And see, that's really interesting because last week we were talking about, you know, the sense that their culture might feel threatened in the East Coast by these outsiders telling them what to do, and that that the same thing kind of happened with commercial whaling, that when commercial whaling was banned, they felt that threat, but they had to learn this sort of new culture to celebrate these whales. And now, of course, as you say, it's this booming industry, and that could set an example for how the seal industry could become.
Oh, you know, on my computer now, I have an article from the Toronto Sun, and it was written by John Crosby. And in this article, he's saying, you know, to understand our support for the seal hunt, you must know a little bit about our history and culture. And a lot of his support for the seal hunt seems to be based on the heritage of seal hunting and the tradition of seal hunting and how it's a way of honoring their forefathers and mothers. Well, I don't understand why you can't honor your forefathers and mothers and celebrate your history with museums and celebrations and say, you know, let's look at these seals alive and do it that way instead of going out and killing them. I don't understand how hunting seals honors your forefathers. You know, I think celebrating the tradition, the wonderful tradition of the Newfoundland lifestyle, the history of Newfoundland is incredible, and it's so rich, and it is so wonderful and fascinating to learn about. But it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, things have changed. Times have changed. And I'm always amazed at the argument whenever you have an economy based on the natural resources, whether it's seal hunting or fishing or the timbering or mining. People always use the argument, oh, it's more than a job, it's a lifestyle. And for some reason, that's supposed to give it more weight. Well, you know, if my father worked in a Ford motor plant, or his father before him and my father, and then I worked in the Ford motor plant, and then that motor plant was closed, well, you know what? That's our tradition. That's our lifestyle. And it was more than a job. My father and father before me, them, they worked at that factory. Why is that so different? You know, I understand things change, and I understand it's a shame that sometimes a way of life passes, but time does march on. You know, I'm a photographer, and a few years ago I was shooting film, and now I'm shooting digital. And, you know, in many ways I'm sorry to see the film go. It was different. But if I want to continue to be a photographer, I have to change with the times.
Change with the times. I think that's a good place to end off. We're out of time, Steve, actually.
Okay.
But I want to thank you so much for being with us. I really like how you put many of your points, so I'm really glad you could be with us and share that inspiration. It's a great idea.
Well, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Great. Thanks, Steve. With Natural Habitat and Green Planet Expeditions, for those links and more info on today's show, visit animalvoices.ca. Stay tuned for Roadrunner.